everyone, and welcome to another episode of From My Point of View. MLB playoffs, we had a quick wild card round. I mean, the games did not go to Saturday. Every game or every series, wild card series, was a sweep, a 2-0 sweep from every team. So pretty uneventful, honestly. They were all really decisive series. And now we're into the divisional rounds of this playoff, and some shocking ones. I mean, the Diamondbacks going up 2-0 on the Dodgers last night, Monday night, was certainly shocking, taking the first two games in LA. The Braves were staring 2-0, going back to Philly, down the barrel of the gun, they were staring this, and were able to rally late in the game with a couple of home runs from Travis d'Arnaud and Austin Riley, and they had a heads up. They stole a run, basically, with Ronald Acuna, who ended up getting on first base. Albies ripped one into right field. Acuna went first to third, and then Castellanos, when he threw the ball into Trey Turner, Turner got eaten up by the short hop, and the ball kind of popped off the heel of his glove and went up on his shoulder, and Acuna basically read that perfectly, stole a run for Atlanta. Then you got the two-run homer from d'Arnaud to make it 4-3. And then Austin Riley, I think it was in the eighth inning, another two-run homer to give them a 5-4 victory. And then, of course, the crazy ending with Harper having a tough base running mistake, you know, trying to get the best jump he could and getting doubled off first base to end the game. Philly was looking 2-0. Going back to Philadelphia, where they are historically good at Citizens Bank Park. And now it's 1-1, and it's anyone's series still. So kind of a huge polar shift there in that game. And then Arizona taking down the Dodgers in two games in LA. They head back to Arizona with only needing one more victory. Quite the eventful NLDS so far. And the ALDS on tonight, Texas dominating Baltimore so far. And then the Astros and Twins, the Twins doing something that was pretty rare, and that's beating the Astros in Houston during the divisional series, something that not many people have been able to do. The Astros have, like, they had a crazy win streak up until the Twins won game two. But yeah, so right now, two series are 2-0, two are tied 1-1. We'll get more into the playoffs in a bit, but just to preview the other stuff to come to this episode, of course, Billy Epler stepping down as general manager of the Mets. So they completely cleaned house. Showalter is out. Epler is out. David Stearns, who, not to toot my own horn, my buddy, who, you know, inside track, my buddy knows the family down there in Texas. And, you know, he was able to tell me that David Stearns was going to be the next GM or the next president of baseball operations for the Mets. A week before it actually was announced. And that was pretty cool to know that in beforehand and to have that, you know, come true. Wasn't just blowing smoke up my ass. So shout out to him. But David Stearns gets a clean slate, which is what Epler cited when he decided to step down from his GM duties. So Steve Cohen having he hired David Stearns, who is now going to hire a completely new front office manager, all that kind of stuff, to try and, I guess, rebuild the Mets. I don't really know. It feels like they're going to try and retool with some other managers. Obviously, those managers and that GM are going to make some decisions regarding some of the players that are already currently on the roster, but it's going to be interesting. So Epler steps down. Jonathan Taylor, after missing the first four games on the PUP list, he is now active, played his first game on Sunday, didn't really do much. But he did sign an extension, so he is there to stay. Clearly, whatever beef him and Irsay and the Colts front office had, they hashed it out. He got money, he got paid, and now he's rejoining the Colts. So good for them, a big addition for them. Even though it's funny because on Sunday, it's Jonathan Taylor's first game back, and Zach Moss rushes for a career high, like 163 yards. So it's always funny how those kind of things work, but. The rest of NFL week five as well, we will get into. So let's just start with this Mets news with Billy Epler resigning from his GM role for the New York Mets. citing that he wants a new president of baseball operations, David Stearns, to have a clean slate. So basically, the Mets starting over in a way. Buck Showalter relieved of his duties. I actually thought Showalter originally, when I saw the news break, I thought he stepped down because I don't think they ever, from what I saw, the reports I saw were that he was like relieved of his duties. I don't know why they didn't say fired. And then I looked it up after the fact, like a week after, and I was like, yeah, he got fired. But originally I thought he had stepped down and he was just like, I'm out. I don't want to do this anymore. But he did get fired. So Showalter out, Billy Epler out. And now you have David Stearns going to come in, hire a new GM, hire a new head coach. I personally would like to see Carlos Beltran get another crack at it. I know that might sound a little weird, but like I was pretty excited when he was announced that he was going to be the head coach of the Mets. I thought that it was an interesting play. I think Carlos Beltran's one of the best like pure hitters in baseball history. Like, I'm not going to say he's like top 10, obviously, but you know, he's a guy who he has what, top three all time in home runs for a switch hitter, like on both sides of the plate, played in the NL and the AL. He's seen a lot of different people, played against a lot of pitchers, from hitting from both sides of the plate, an exceptional center fielder, of course, with his glove, a very good base runner. I just feel like he was for a long part of his career, he was a five tool player. You know, he was fast. He had a great glove. He had a great arm. He could hit for power. He was an MVP candidate for, you know, a handful of years there with the Mets. I just really liked watching Carlos Beltran play. His swing is so beautiful. He's one of those guys who's just a very graceful baseball player. And I feel like having that could help a lot, you know, with the Yankees. It's like Aaron Boone. He wasn't ever like a great baseball player. You know, he only spent like 2 years with the Yankees. He obviously has that iconic moment, hitting that walk-off against Tim Wakefield in extras. RIP Tim Wakefield, by the way. Devastating news to hear that he passed away from brain cancer, which he had not disclosed to the public. So quite a jarring bit of news and very sad, of course. So prayers up to his family. But with Aaron Boone, he, you know, never had like this crazy. He was never an exceptionally talented baseball player in terms of like one of the best players in the league. You know, like Carlos Beltran for a hot period of time was one of the best players in baseball. He was a stud. So I was like really excited to see what he could offer from a managerial standpoint, because, you know, later on in his career, when his play definitely declined and he got a lot older and he put on some weight and all that, he was DHing a little bit, but he was really almost like a player coach in a way. And, you know, to see everyone on the Astros, like, yeah, it was a bad thing that they did. And by no means can you condone that kind of behavior. It was scumbag behavior. It was low. It wasn't right. But, you know, since then, they've been to two more World Series, three more. They've been to three other World Series. They won last year. They lost to the Braves and they lost to the Nationals. So all in all, five World Series appearances four World Series appearances for this Astros team, where they beat the Dodgers, they lost to the Nationals, they lost to the Braves, and then they beat the Phillies last year. So really, really like good franchise, honestly. Like I hate them because of how they completely demolish the Yankees every single time they play them. But, you know, for them, it's like, yeah, they cheated that 1 year, but like they also went to three other World Series and won another one. So it's like, how long are you just going to harken back to, you know, they cheated to win that World Series, or they cheated that entire season? If they had not been to another World Series since then, yeah, you put like a lot more stock into that. Like, it was literally only because they cheated, but that's just not the case. So with all those guys kind of having other successes, all those other players from that team, moving on and having other successes and playing well and having other playoff success. It's like, especially Altuve and Correa, even though Correa hasn't had the best regular season since he's left Houston, is still a force in the playoffs. He really, the guy lives for the playoffs, which you got to tip your cap to him in that regard. He came up clutch in game two for Minnesota. So like, that is what it is, but why is Beltran not allowed to get a clean slate? You know, why can't the Mets kind of circle back and say, maybe we announce Belt? Because people kind of were really, they were open to it. They were open. I know some of my friends who were Mets fans, they were open to the idea of having Beltran come in and be that player. There's a lot of Puerto Ricans on the Mets roster where, you know, for someone like Beltran, like that means a lot, playing on the Puerto Rican national team, being a part of that team and having that connection. A lot of guys look up to him, you know? And I think, actually, you know, I said there's a lot of Puerto Ricans on the Mets team. And then I started thinking about it while I kept talking. It's real. I know Lindor is Puerto Rican. I'm not sure who else is Puerto Rican on the Mets team. But regardless, that is still in itself like a pretty heavy draw, you know, to have like your starting shortstop and, you know, your best player and your manager have that connection. Because if you've ever seen the Puerto Rican national team play in like the World Baseball Classic, all of those dudes love each other. And like, they're all really close. They all, like when they play against each other in the bigs, it's always like all love and all that kind of stuff. So it's like, that's a big draw. I think Beltran, like I said, has had a lot of success as a player, is a very intelligent player. So I would like to see the Mets maybe circle back and see if they can get that to go. Odds are that's not going to happen, but I would still like to see it happen. Like I said, highly unlikely, but it would be nice because, you know, again, when you look at the guys who were in on that team during that cheating scandal and all that, everyone's kind of moved on and have had their own different successes and whatnot. And, you know, the team themselves had a lot of success. So I think it's a bit weird that Beltran may be the only guy who's like not going to get a second chance, but whatever. Maybe I'm being nitpicky, but I'm sure it's not going to be Beltran. It's probably going to be some other outside person to come in. I am curious to see who they hire as their GM. That's going to be a huge step. But to see where the Mets go in terms of like, what is this new head coach and this GM going to do? You know, are they going to sell off a lot of pieces? Is Alonso going to get an extension? Are some of these guys like Marte, like they already got rid of Canna. Is Marte going to stick around? Is McNeil going to stick around? Like Nimmo, they just signed to a contract. He's probably here to stay. But like some of these other guys, you know, what's going to happen? Are you going to bring up some of your younger talent? I think it would be a mistake to let Pete Alonso go, but I understand you're going to have to pay him some money. And if it's like you don't really feel like you can compete, then so be it. But like if you're going to let Alonso walk and you're not going to extend him, then what's the point of keeping Lindor under this massive contract that you have? Like, why would you not try and get rid of him as well? But it's a whole lot of ifs, ends, or buts. I don't know. But it's a weird position that the Mets are in because obviously they were favorites to compete for a World Series and then they, you know, to finish under 500. And now everyone's, you know, they got their whole front office and their manager's gone. So it's, you just kind of have to figure it all out now in a different sense. Who you keeping, who you trading, who you not extending, all that stuff that's really, you know, it can make or break you. So they got to figure it out. But it is certainly a shocking turn of events for the New York Mets. All right, let's roll right into the MLB playoffs now. Some games last night, but overall, the wild card, not very wild. The Rangers took two from the Rays in Tampa Bay. The Rays stadium was kind of the talk of that series. You know, this is a team that came in second in the AL East, won 99 games. Really good all year. Basically no one at the stand. I think they said it was like 17,000 people at this game. Like really empty stadium. And it sucks because I think a lot of people were talking about how they're the Tampa Bay Rays, but they play in St. Petersburg, Florida. Like, they don't play in Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay is a nice area, a lot of young people who want to go to sporting events. They want to see, like, that's where they really should be, but they're not. They're in St. Petersburg, which it's not the same as being in Tampa Bay, even though they are the Tampa Bay Rays. That it's a problem. Like, you know, there's all the talk of them moving to Montreal or whatever, but honestly, if they just moved to Tampa Bay, like if they moved across the street from where the Bucs Stadium is, it would solve a lot of problems, in terms of, you know, attendance. But really, like, no home field advantage at all. The Rangers had no problems with the Rays. They beat them 4-0 and 7-1. So they take it 2-0. The Twins in Minnesota, they get the Blue Jays. Blue Jays, again, underperforming completely. Their pitching just did not show up, and their offense did not show up. Just one game, one run. Well, the Rays, it's funny. The Rays and the Blue Jays, both AL East teams, they chalked up just 2 runs in 4 combined games between the two of them. So really, really tough offensive struggles for both teams. So the Twins, it was their first playoff series victory since 2002, I believe. And I guess because when you look at it, I actually went back and looked at the Twins team playoff history, because I was like, how? They like never won like a one-off playoff wild card. And they haven't, because they either win the AL Central or they don't make the playoffs, because the AL Central is not a particularly good division. It's always very up and down. The winner of that division is generally kind of a mediocre team compared to everybody else. And that's not a knock. That's just like the way it's been. And I know personally, as a Yankees fan, we've gotten matched up with the Twins multiple times, and every time the Yankees beat the brakes off them. So they don't really ever get far. But yeah, the Twins have never even been in a wild card. It's either they miss the playoffs or they win the division, in which case they don't have to play a wild card. But now they do, because of the expanded playoffs. It never used to be that way. But now, because they made that third wild card a playoff spot, where it used to be just the first two wild card, they have 2 wild card spots, and then those 2 wild card teams play each other in a one-off playoff to go into the divisional series. That third wild card spot now takes the lowest record of the divisional winners and pits them against one of the wild card teams. So the Twins had to play the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays were a wild card team. The Twins had home field advantage. And they ended up winning 2-0. Again, I really love this wild card format. It's so much better than the one-off playoff thing. I do like the best of 3, because now it kind of increases best of 3, best of 5, best of 7, best of 7. So the Twins, they had no problem with the Blue Jays. Blue Jays, once again, underperforming, like I said. The Diamondbacks take out the Brewers 2-0. The NL Central winning Brewers go out with a whimper against the Arizona Diamondbacks, who are on fire right now. They have not lost in the playoffs yet. Team of Destiny vibes almost happening right now with Arizona, but they are a force. I mean, their pitching staff, headed by Zach Gallen, very good. Evan Longoria had a really good wild card series against the Brewers. Spectacular glove. He's had some really good hits against the Dodgers so far through the first 2 games. So he's kind of 38 years old. He's rejuvenated now, back to his old self when he was a hero for Tampa Bay. So Arizona takes it 2-0. And then Philly, they have absolutely no problems with the Marlins. Again, the Marlins just scratching up 2 runs in 2 games, and the Phillies offense just absolutely dominating. That Phillies lineup is a wagon. So that was the playoff matchup. Let's get into last night. We'll talk real quick Sunday. The Rangers have been dominating. Their lineup has been unbelievable, where the Orioles just haven't really been able to quite put it together enough. Rangers win the first game 3-2. Astros win game 1, 6-4. And then on Sunday, The Rangers win game two, 11-8. They went up big early. The Orioles rallied to try and make it a close game, but in the end, it wasn't enough. The Rangers just put too many runs on the board too early, and you run out of innings to play, you know? So the Rangers win 11-8. They go up 2-0. They win both games in Baltimore from the AL East, winning Baltimore Orioles, who I'm kind of rooting for. I have a friend who's an Orioles fan. There's a lot of really good young players on that team. And honestly, like, as a Yankees fan, you never really think twice about the Orioles. But now you kind of have to. Like, they're a really good team. And same thing with the Blue Jays. Like, yeah, they made the playoffs too, but I don't really think twice about the Blue Jays either. But yeah, the Orioles, really, really good. A really good team. And they're down 2-0. I mean, Texas, the Rangers lineup has just been unstoppable. And you look at a lot of these teams, and it's not really pitching that has been winning them games. It's their offenses. So you look at the Twins there, game two, 6-2. They win and they tie the series at one, take one in Houston, go back to Minnesota, one game apiece. And then Monday. So Monday's the big one. You had the Phillies on Saturday, who were just their pitching one was dominant. Braves put up a zero on the board at home in game one. They lose 3-0 to Philadelphia. And then the Diamondbacks, they put up 6 runs, I think, in the first inning against Clayton Kershaw, who you feel for Clayton Kershaw. I'm glad he got his ring. To everyone who says it's a Mickey Mouse ring, it's a tournament, it's dumb, piss off, like, you're a fool, you're a clown. It's not a Mickey Mouse ring. You know, that's a Dodgers team that they've been to the World Series how many times? They've been so deep into the playoffs how many times? They deserved a ring. They deserved that, and they got it. And honestly, now you look at, I think Clayton Kershaw, there was this quote he had where, "I'd rather fail on the biggest stages than not even have the opportunity at all," which, like, tip of the cap to Clayton Kershaw. He is an unbelievable player. First ballot Hall of Famer. He's very clearly not the same player that he used to be, but he is still, I think, reliable. It sucks that this happened in game one at home in LA. You get shelled for 6 runs in the first inning. Diamondbacks end up winning 11-2. And now we go to Monday night. We covered the ALDS already and some of those games, in terms of the Rangers and the Orioles. Again, offense just crazy for the Rangers. The Twins, Carlos Correa coming up huge for Minnesota in Houston. And he was saying, like, he went out to dinner and breakfast before game one, and he had Astros fans coming up to him being like, "Hey, man, we wish you luck. Good luck," all that kind of stuff. "Hope you play well." And he's like, "Are you sure about that? Like, you really want me to play well? Because it's not going to go well for you if I do." And game one, Astros were able to handle it. Game two, who pitched for the Twins? I think Pablo Lopez was the pitcher for Minnesota in game two. Pitched a gem. You remember they traded Luis Arraez to the Marlins for Pablo Lopez in the offseason, which honestly, it seems like both teams really made out pretty well on that deal. The Marlins made the playoffs. Yeah, they got pitted against the Phillies and just couldn't really do it, which, by the way, the Marlins, Sandy Alcantara missing all of 2024. He got Tommy John surgery, just an absolutely devastating blow for the 2022 NL Cy Young Award winner. Sandy Alcantara is going to miss the entire season. He had a little bit of an up and down year this year. He was dealing with some injury. I think all those innings he's thrown kind of caught up to him a little bit, unfortunately, which is sad because he's such a rare breed of pitcher that is able to pitch so many innings. And you thought, like, maybe this was just going to be, he was going to be a guy that's a workhorse, but they did seem to catch up to him. So that's really unfortunate that he's going to miss all of next year, because he is an unbelievable pitcher. But that trade really worked out for both of them, because now you're at the Twins in the playoffs, ALDS against the Astros. Pablo Lopez comes up huge for them, and they win that game too. And now you go to Monday night. We'll start with, we'll work backwards here just because there's more to talk about with the Braves and Phillies game. But the Diamondbacks, they get out to an early lead, 3-0 lead in the first inning again. So this time it was against Bobby Miller, which Bobby Miller just, he struggled with control. He was throwing, you know, pitches high, going over Will Smith's head, just throwing in the dirt. He's throwing them high. He just had really lack of control. Dave Roberts went to the bullpen early, and you know, LA was kind of able to rally a little bit, but at the end, it just wasn't enough. Arizona only need one more run really to secure. I mean, they didn't even really need that extra run. It's just insurance run. They end up winning 4-2. So they got off to a quick start again in two games against the Dodgers in this NLDS. They've scored 9 runs in the first inning, which is just like, it's a recipe for disaster if you're Los Angeles. So they have to figure it out. Zach Gallen, he went 5 1/3, just tremendous, tremendous pitcher. Guy's an absolute freak. And Arizona's bullpen was able to hold it down. They had a really, really good first two games here in LA. And now you go back to Arizona and you're feeling great. I mean, you need one win, just one, and you're on to the NLCS. Again, team of destiny almost, they're feeling like. And this other game here, pretty crazy ending to this one. The Phillies and the Braves, after winning the first game 3-0, Zach Wheeler comes out and the first time through the lineup, Zach Wheeler strikes out 7 Braves. So the first time through the lineup, again, Zach Wheeler strikes out 7 Braves. He was absolutely dominating. He carried a no-hitter into the 6th inning, and then that's when the wheels kind of started to fall off a little bit. So he goes into the 6th inning, no hits. He walks Acuna. Albies rips a single into right field. Acuna goes first to third. Castellanos throws the ball in. Trey Turner on the cutoff kind of gets eaten up by the ball. Acuna makes a great read on the base pads, scores basically from first base on. They gave the error to Turner, so it was an unearned run for Zach Wheeler, but he scores. Now it's 4-1. Then you have, in the bottom of the 7th inning, Travis d'Arnaud launches a home run into left field. There you go, 4-3. Suddenly the Braves are back in it. Philly still can't get anything going on offense now after the Braves bullpen. Like, Max Fried really struggled. Who was the home plate umpire for this game? Because he was not giving any calls low. Nothing at the Ben May was the home plate umpire for this game. Anything low in the zone, he was not giving the outside corner, inside corner, down middle of the plate, nothing low was ever getting called a strike. So Max Fried was getting pretty frustrated, and you could tell if you were watching that game. But he was consistent, which is like, you got it. Sometimes you get frustrated and you're like, I can't believe this isn't getting called a strike. He's not getting these calls, yada, yada, yada. But he was consistent. So that's all you can ask for unless you're Angel Hernandez, where it's like consistent means, you know, 5 feet off the plate is a strike. But Max Fried didn't have the best outing, but the Braves bullpen really, really came in clutch. AJ Minter especially was just sensational in his appearance this game. And the bullpen in general, just 5 innings, no run baseball, allowing this lineup to do what this lineup does, and that is hit home runs. They tied, I think, an MLB record for most home runs this season. So, like 6 guys in this lineup had 25 plus home runs. It's insane. They're completely stacked. And now the lid finally seems like it's off. You know, obviously in game one, they got shut out. Half of game two, they could do absolutely nothing. And Ronald Acuna, the about to be announced NL MVP, made something happen on the base paths. He generated a run off of one hit. They remember they had no hits before that. Acuna walks, Albies gets the first hit for the Braves, and Acuna is able to score off of a bad error from Trey Turner. And that finally kind of created a spark for the Braves. D'Arnaud hits a 2-run homer in the bottom of the 7th. Now it's 4-3. All of a sudden, now the pressure's back on Philly. Oh my God, what are we going to do? We need an insurance run. Couldn't get it. Braves bullpen was dominating. Then you go into the bottom of the 8th, and Austin Riley hits another nuke. He was even a little out in front of it, but was still able to get the head of the bat onto the ball and launch it out. another home run to put them up 5-4. And then you come in the top of the ninth. I think Minter was there. He came out to face Harper, where he walked Harper, and then Iglesias came in to finish the game. And they get one out, and then this is where we have like that crazy end of the game. So Minter walks Harper because lefty on lefty, you want that. Iglesias not going to come in as a righty to face Harper. That would be silly. I think Harper splits against Iglesias are like laugh out loud funny. So Iglesias warming up, you get Minter to pitch against Harper. He was very, very conservative against Harper. You don't want him to tie the game with one swing of the bat like he's capable of. He ends up walking Harper. Iglesias comes in. He gets Real Muto to fly out to center field to get one out. And this is where the double play that happens. That's really tough. So Castellanos launches a ball to center field. I mean, he crushed this thing, and I think maybe he misses it by like a half an inch on his bat from hitting a home run to dead center field to take the lead. But Michael Harris in center field makes an unbelievable play, tracking the ball to the warning track, to the wall. He jumps, makes the catch as he jumps into the wall. Harper is reading this thing like it has to drop. It's going to hit the wall. He's not going to get there. So he's like probably three steps around second base where he sees Michael Harris make this catch. Red lights start flashing for Harper. He has to retreat all the way to back to first base. He's rounding second. And Michael Harris, actually, in an attempt to try and get this ball in as quickly as possible, just kind of grabs it and then launches it back into the infield. It sails over two cutoff men. It sails over Arcia and Albies, and Austin Riley having just unbelievable baseball instincts. You know, he's not needed at third base. Harper's at first. So having great baseball instincts, Austin Riley is making a mad dash to the middle of the field. And when this ball sails over both of these, the middle infielders' heads, Arcia and Albies, Austin Riley is there to intercept the ball to keep it from going past the pitcher's mound. And then in one fluid motion, gets the ball off the cutoff, off one foot, off balance, fires an absolute dart to first base. To Matt Olson, like an absolute dart, chest high strike to Matt Olson to get Harper right before he slides back into first base. And the Braves erupt in cheer. It was a crazy double play, a really heads up play by Austin Riley. Great baseball instincts. The guy he's an unbelievable baseball player, dude. I feel like he's really good. And I just feel like, you know, you have Acuna, who's MVP. Matt Olson, you know, led the league in RBIs and home runs. You have those guys in front of you, and it's almost like Austin Riley got a little bit slept on this year, but he's so good. He is a very, very good baseball player, and that you cannot teach third baseman how to do that. You can't do it. That is simply like him reading the play, looking at where his cutoff guys are, and just kind of floating himself into that vicinity. And as soon as he sees that ball coming in, he knows it's coming over their heads and they're not going to be able to cut it off. So he gets into a great position and makes a heads up play to deliver an absolute strike to Matt Olson to double off Harper. You can't really blame Bryce Harper for doing that. I really can't, because this ball off Castellanos' bat was launched. And, you know, Harper is reading this ball like he's trying to make a play. He's trying to make a play on the base paths. He's trying to score. You know, they need this run. And would you have liked to see someone else come up and try to get a crack at it? Yeah, but at the same time, like, this is the heart of your order here. You know, 4-5, not really almost the heart of your order. It's 4-5-6. But you have Harper, Real Muto, and Castellanos. Like, that's the best chance you're going to get to try and tie this game, honestly. So it's tough because you're reading it and you think the ball is launched and you're looking at it and you're like, oh yeah, like that's going to hit the wall. And I can score. Like, in a different universe, Michael Harris jumps a little too early, jumps a little too late. The ball goes over his glove. It hits the wall and ricochets out. Now Harper scores easily. You know, like, that's what he's looking at. That's what he's anticipating. He's trying to make a play. And Michael Harris just made an unbelievable play on this ball. He's a gold glove caliber center fielder. This guy is an absolute freaking stud. Makes a great play, makes a bad throw. He makes a bad throw to his cutoff men. Like, that ball needs to go to one of those two cutoff men, traditionally speaking, you know, and then it happened to luck out because Austin Riley makes an unbelievable high IQ baseball play, getting to that middle of the field in anticipation that seeing that this ball is going to sail over his cutoff men's head, cutting it off himself, and then making a great throw to Matt Olson, which also could have ended in disaster. Like, if Matt Olson skips that ball, maybe it gets past. I mean, if Riley skips that ball, maybe it gets past Matt Olson. Now, all of a sudden, Harper puts himself in scoring position anyway. You know, there's risk factors involved. You can never assume anything's going to go as expected in baseball. It is a cruel sport. And I remember watching half of this game and I'm tweeting out, like, baseball is such a cruel sport because the Braves won 104 games. They were the best team in the league. And, like, Philly is just giving it to them, just absolutely dominating. And it's like, there's nothing, absolutely nothing that Philly can do. They wasted it on Zach Wheeler's great performance. Although maybe they left Zach Wheeler in a little bit too long. Who knows? But there was this moment where you're looking at it and you're like, how is this happening to Atlanta? And then in the same breath, in the same game, this was two completely different halves of games. Up until that first run was scored by Acuna, Philly had dominated. And then the rest of the game, the last four innings of the game, three and a half innings of the game, whatever you want to call it, Atlanta dominated. They showed their true colors. They were like, this is why we won 104 games. Their lineup got them this win. Their bats generated offense. They had clutch hits, home runs. And it was like, I tweeted out after, and it's like, and just like that, like, Philly gets punched in the mouth, and now Atlanta is tying this game. Like, if you're Atlanta, you're staring down the barrel of a gun, 2-0, losing both games at home, and have to go back to Citizen Bank Park, where the Phillies are historically good in the playoffs. And I think they said on the broadcast last night, they were 8-2 last postseason at Citizen Bank Park. So they were historically good. Not even last year, just in general, they're very good at home. So, not great. I mean, you have to win 3 games in a row now if you're Atlanta. That's what you're looking at. And I'm sure that's what everyone was kind of thinking. And then all of a sudden, Darno hits that home run. You're like, wait a second, hold the phone. We can win this game. And then they do. So now it's anybody's series. You know, this went from being Philly has a chokehold on Atlanta to now it's a complete 50-50 toss-up. Both of these lineups are exceptionally good. They can all score. They can both score runs at rapid paces. They have guys who can come up in the clutch at any given time. I think when you look at their pitching staff, it's kind of interesting because, you know, Strider has really struggled in the playoffs for the Braves so far in his young career. Max Fried did not look good last night. And on the other end, you know, is the Phillies bullpen reliable? Because Zach Wheeler looked great. Game one, you know, they were fantastic. They shut out the Braves. Tip of the cap. That was a fantastic performance. But in this game now, like, Zach Wheeler kind of struggles a little bit towards the tail end of that start. They start kind of hitting him a little bit. Then you bring in the bullpen and the Braves just keep it rolling. Not good, you know? It's tough. So it's a little bit of a toss-up in terms of almost a complete opposite in the terms of the half. Like, you have game one, nothing went right for the Braves. And everything went right for the Phillies. The starting pitching was great. Bullpen was great. Lineup scored runs. Braves did absolutely nothing of any of those things. Game two, it's a flip-flop. Both teams are scoring runs. 5-4 victory. Philly has great starting pitching. Atlanta doesn't. But Atlanta's bullpen pitches 5 scoreless innings. Phillies does not. You know, it's a toss-up. These teams are so evenly matched. And then you add the fact that they've played each other so many times during this regular season because I think everyone plays exactly the same amount of times, right? Because of the new scheduling changes. But regardless, you have played these guys so many times in the past, these core teams in general speaking. over the past 2 or 3 years have played each other so many times and they've been super competitive and, you know, they really know each other, you know, and the divisional rivalry aspect of it is a whole nother layer of it. And they really are just punching each other in the face repeatedly. And I saw a post-game thing with Castellanos talking about in the locker room, like, we're our best after we get punched in the mouth. And you want to talk about a punch in the mouth, thinking that, like, you're going to go up, going back to Philadelphia up 2-0, and now all of a sudden it's 1-1. That's a punch in the mouth. So we'll see how they respond. But this is definitely the best series of the divisional round, no doubt about it. You know, the Twins and the Astros, 1-1, good series. You have the Correa versus former team aspect of it as well. But overall, you know, I'm not sure how many people care about the Minnesota Twins. And I hate to rag on them, but, like, it's true. Like, how many people are watching the Minnesota Twins play the Houston Astros? Philly and Atlanta is a much, much, much better series and way more competitive. And then you have the Rangers are just completely slaughtering the Orioles. But tonight, Tuesday night, you have game 3 of the ALDS for both series, Astros at Minnesota and then the Orioles at Texas. We'll see what happens there. All right, time to get into the NFL. We've talked plenty about baseball now. So week five of the NFL season, we'll start. So the Thursday night game, quite a shocker, but honestly, if you're a follower of storylines, it's not, and I really kick myself in the face every single time this happens. Dick Butkus, one of the best linebackers of all time, Chicago Bears legend, he passed away on Thursday before the game started. If you were a follower of storylines and if you're a smart person, which I kind of joked about this, but at the same time, like, I definitely should have done it, should have bet Bears money line, just straight up Bears money line, Bears to win. They were going to win this game for Dick Butkus, and they sure did. They put up 40 on the Commanders, who I thought the Commanders defense had been good, but they are a revolving door. They cannot stop anybody. The Bears put up 40. Justin Fields had a great game. DJ Moore was the player of the game, though. Sorry, Justin Fields. But DJ Moore, 8 catches, 230 yards, and 3 touchdowns for DJ Moore. Just a sensational game for him. Absolutely exploded. And the Bears are on the board. They have 1 win. So congratulations to them. RIP Dick Butkus, a all-time football guy, all-time football player, and an all-time linebacker. Very sad news. We'll start with the London game. The Jaguars beating the Bills in a shocker, 25-20. And honestly, as much as I hate to do this, I'm going to chalk it up to the fact that the Jaguars stayed in London. The Jaguars have been in London since last Sunday because they had back-to-back games in London, which is just, like, first of all, absolutely asinine. But regardless, they had back-to-back games in London. The Bills obviously did not. They had to travel to London, and their offense just looked all sorts of out of whack. The defense looked great for the most part. Travis Etienne really sealed the game at the end with a touchdown when the Bills were kind of being vaguely threatening to them to make, like, a comeback here. But for the most part, the Bills defense was horrific. I mean, the Bills offense was horrific. They just could not get much of going about anything. A week after they absolutely dominate the Dolphins, you know, they got to travel to London. There's a time difference. There's that jet lag. People say, you know, you're not going to be at your best when you travel to London, but generally speaking, you have two teams traveling at the same time, so it kind of offsets, and now you're both kind of dealing with the same circumstances, so it's really not that big of a deal. But in this case, that's not the truth at all, because the Bills had to travel, whereas the Jaguars were kind of just sitting cozy there for 2 weeks. They were living it up in London, and it showed, because the Jaguars looked a lot better. They looked a lot crisper. I still don't think they're very good. I really think they're overrated. I don't really feel comfortable betting on them at all, but here we are. They're 3-2. Both teams are 3-2, which just doesn't feel right at all, because I feel like the Bills are just a significantly better team. But Again, Travis Etienne, 2 fourth-quarter touchdowns. He kind of seals it for Jacksonville. And they are both 3-2. So we'll work our way down the list here for the rest of the games. Starting with the Giants and Dolphins, this game went about as you expected. The Dolphins, 31-16. They crushed the Giants. Devon Achane. He told us how to pronounce it. But another spectacular day for him. Unfortunately, he suffered a knee injury in the fourth quarter and is hoping to avoid IR, but is going to miss a couple weeks, they said, as so far are the reports, which is devastating. I mean, this rookie was an absolute freak for like the past 3 weeks. He's been unstoppable. So a tough blow for the Dolphins, but at the same time, you still have Mostert, who's a very good running back, and now Jeff Wilson, who's been on the IR since the beginning of the year, is now coming back to kind of fill that role, and you'll still have a good some good running backs back there. Two former 49ers guys, of course, with Mostert and Wilson, and then McDaniel, you know, he siphoned them away from San Francisco. But Devon Achane, just an absolute stud. So hopefully for a speedy recovery for him, because he's been sensational. But yeah, this game went about as you can expect. The Dolphins D-line looked like every other defensive line that's ever played against the New York Giants this season. Absolutely dominant. Daniel Jones actually left this game in the fourth quarter with a neck injury. He said he will be fine, but at this point, the Giants are 1-4. They look like one of the worst teams in football, and I don't really see any reason why Daniel Jones should go out there and play next week. They're playing the Buffalo Bills, which, like, that defense is disgusting. Like, they have an unbelievable defensive front. They really get after it. Von Miller came back and played in that London game, which is something I forgot to mention. I apologize. But Von Miller is active. He played in the London game, and you have to imagine he's probably even going to get more snaps now against the Giants. Really, this is like a prep game for him. Like, why, if you're Sean McDermott, like, just play Von Miller as many snaps as he thinks he can handle, because he's going to be feasting against this Giants offensive line. They suck. I'm out on Evan Neal after he said, you know, fans, they shouldn't be booing because they're losers who are just like hot dogs and hamburger flippers. Like, you're a scumbag. Why would you ever say that about your fan base? That quite literally never goes well. And I don't care about any notes app apology or anything like that. You can't take back what you said. You said what you said. You definitely obviously meant it, because sometimes when you're angry, you say things that you think are true. But he is a jerk off, man. Like, he stinks. He won't be around. We won't pick up his option. We're not extending him. And he's not, I don't think he's gonna be able to turn it around. I think he's bad. Like, they have some, you can look up Evan Neal lowlights. He's not good. So regardless, the Giants, I mean, they play the Bills next week, as I said, and I see no reason why you should send, if it's a neck injury for Daniel Jones, which he has suffered before, I don't see any reason why he should be playing in this game. Bench him, not bench him, but rest him for the week. Like, you're not winning games with him. You're not going to beat the, it's not like he's going to be the X factor that helps you beat the Bills. And honestly, if Saquon Barkley isn't absolutely 100%, don't play him either. Just run the backups out there. Is it going to be a massacre? Yes. But, you know, ideally it's like 30-0 at halftime and the Bills just run the ball and run the clock out for the rest of the game, because the Giants aren't going to score. So that is, it's brutal. It's brutal, dude. I mean, the Giants scored 16 points. 7 of those were off a, I think it was like 100 yards almost. Let me see how long. Pinnock came up with the interception. 102-yard interception return for a touchdown by Jason Pinnock, which was the highlight of the night, or the afternoon, because he scored that touchdown, and then all of a sudden, with 1:40 left in the second quarter, it's 14-10. You're thinking, oh, wow, the Giants are going to be scrappy today. But no, the Dolphins are able to drive down the field with that 1:40, kick a field goal. It's 17-10. Then they come out in the second half, immediately score a touchdown, a 69-yard touchdown with Tyreek Hill, and it's 24-10. And then from there on, it's over. I mean, the Giants kick 2 more field goals after that. So actually, their only touchdown of the game was a 102-yard interception return. All things considered, the Giants' defense, I don't think, is particularly bad. And you can look at their games and look at the final scores and be like, they're giving up all these points. Like, what do you mean they're not good? But honestly, it's like the offense can't score. And not only can't the offense score, they can't move the ball effectively. Like they have one to three drives all game where they look kind of competent. And sometimes a lot of those drives end in field goals, which are not going to necessarily instill confidence in your team if you're settling for field goals every time you drive down the field. So the fact that the Giants can't put together cohesive drive after cohesive drive, they're constantly giving the ball back to the opposing team's offense. And their defense is on the field a lot. Go ahead and look at the time of possession for all of these games. The Giants get slaughtered in that category. Like they aren't on the field for long periods of time, the offense. So therefore, the defense has to be out there longer. And the longer the defense is out there, the more they get gashed for big plays because everyone is tired. They're inconsistent. And then they go back to the sideline after a team drives down the field for like 8, 9, 10 plays and scores a touchdown. Now you go back to the sideline, your offense goes out there, they get a 3 and out, or maybe they pick up 1 first down and they go 6 plays, they punt the ball. Now the defense has to go back out there. It's draining, you know, but for the most part, I think the defense has been pretty good. Again, the offense not being able to put together significant drives and score the football does them no favors. Titans, Colts. The Colts win 23-16. I think it's safe to say bet against the Titans when they're on the road, bet on them when they're home. That seems to be the kind of route that they're going this season, because you look at their season so far, they lose at New Orleans 16-15. They beat the Chargers in OT at home 27-24. They get slaughtered by the Browns at Cleveland 27-3. Then they slaughter the Bengals at home 27-3. And then they go to Indianapolis and lose 23-16. Unfortunately, next Sunday they're playing. Is this game in London or is this in Germany? It's in London, in the Tottenham. So this is the London game next week. It's the Ravens at Tennessee. Obviously, this is not a home. This is not a true home game for Tennessee. So I would probably stay away from that one because you never know how London games go. But the week after that against the Falcons, like bet on the Titans. They're going to beat the Falcons at home. That's just the way this season's been going for them. As for the Colts, you have to feel for Anthony Richardson. Like this dude needs to figure it out. Honestly, he really, really does. He cannot get out of his own way. He continuously gets hurt. I feel bad for him. Like he really needs to like understand that he is the future of this team. He needs to learn to not take these big hits. Obviously, he's a tank. Like he's a huge guy. Built like Cam Newton, really. I think he's a little shorter than Cam Newton. He might be like what, 6'3", Anthony Richardson? No, not really. He's 6'4". So like an inch shorter than Cam Newton, maybe 2. I think Cam might have been 6'6", but still, he's built like a linebacker. This guy is enormous. He has a huge arm. He can run. Like, I get it. Certain scenarios, yeah, maybe you'd like to see him put his shoulder down and hit somebody if it's like a close game or whatever and you need to win. But like at the same time, look what happened to Cam Newton. It took one hit to the shoulder to completely end his career from TJ Watt. That's what ended Cam Newton. And with Anthony Richardson, like, you're off to a dangerous start, brother. You are off to a dangerous start. This guy is just getting hammered. And you really, like, some of it is his fault, maybe. Yeah, like in game one where against Jacksonville, he's, like, running it himself and he doesn't go down and he has to, like, miss the last 3 plays of the game with a leg injury. That's his fault. The concussion, his fault. This one, maybe not so much. He gets tackled. He lands in an awkward position where his shoulder gets dug into the ground. Now it's an AC joint sprain. Now he's going to miss significant time. Now it's Gardner Minshew time. You know, like this is like something where, I mean, the Colts, he's clearly talented. And, you know, I had my skepticisms about maybe playing him from the get-go for Indianapolis. I thought maybe he might have been better served if Gardner Minshew just started the season and then maybe halfway through the season, whatever it is, you give Anthony Richardson a whirl, but like in terms of talent, he can hang. Like, I don't think there's any like rookie, or I mean, obviously there are rookie pains, you know, that's going to happen to every rookie, in the league for the most part. I mean, CJ Stroud is maybe the exception to the rule, but he seems to be really comfortable so far throwing the football. But Anthony Richardson, all things considered, you could tell he has the physical tools to be successful. He has a good arm. He can run. Like, he's big. He can do it. It's just now he's just off to a really unfortunate start with these injuries. This is his third injury, his third kind of significant injury in a short window. We're 5 weeks into the season and he's left the game three separate times with injuries. Can't happen. Now he's going to miss a month, and hopefully the fact that he misses significant time kind of drives it into his skull that you can't be taking these kind of hits. You know, you got to protect yourself, because the other three times or the other two times, maybe he kind of thought it's not that bad. You know, he misses a game because of the concussion. He leaves temporarily because of a leg injury, but he plays next game. Then he gets a concussion. He misses a game. He comes back. He's like, I'm fine. Now he gets his shoulder driven into the ground. He has an AC joint sprain. He's going to miss a month. And again, hopefully that kind of drives home the point to him that you need to protect yourself if you want to be successful, if you want to be the future of this team like we drafted you to be. He just has to be smart, man. He really does. The biggest beatdown of the week was actually not the Giants and Dolphins. It was the Saints and the Patriots. The Saints beat the Pats 34-0. The Patriots have been outscored 72-3 in the last two games. They lost 38-3 to the Cowboys and 34-0 to the Saints, which last week against the Cowboys was Bill Belichick's largest deficit of loss in his career. And they came damn close to beating it. I mean, if that's 37 or what is this? 35 points was the largest deficit. Saints scored 34-0. So they came one field goal shy of resetting the record that had just been set the previous week. It was a slaughter. I mean, the Saints defense was spectacular, flat out great. Now the whole week now is basically talk about and already is Bill Belichick done? Should he continue to be the coach of the New England Patriots? And, you know, I've ragged on my show, on this podcast, I've ragged about Stephen A. Smith and how, you know, sometimes his football knowledge might not be up to par, up to standard with some of the other people that he has on his show, et cetera. But he made a good point where he said, if he's Robert Kraft, he takes Bill Belichick into his office and says, you can continue to coach this team because you're a great coach, but you are no longer in charge of personnel decisions. And if Bill Belichick doesn't accept that, then it should be his last year coaching for the New England Patriots. And I think that was a very, very, very fair assessment, because the Patriots are kind of in a tough position here where Bill Belichick is an all-time great coach. He was a great coach before Brady. He was the best coach with Brady. I still think he's a good coach. I think, you know, when it comes to defensive schemes and stuff, he still is one of the best. But in terms of personnel decisions, if he is a guy who has a strong say in who to draft and who to sign and all that, he's done a horrible job. He has. The Patriots have not filled their team with specifically good players. Defensively, they have. Defensively, like I said, he's still one of the best when it comes defensively, because they drafted Christian Gonzalez, who is now on the IR, which sucks, but he's proven to be already a good draft pick. Matthew Judon, unbelievable signing for them. He's been a freak. He's insane. Also on the IR. So, yeah, there's been some injury concerns, but for the most part, their defensive signings are not the problem. It's the offense, and Belichick has never really been an offensive guru in terms of who to sign. I mean, you look at Brady's tenure there, they've really, outside of tight ends, I mean, they were blessed with Gronk and then Aaron Hernandez, and then Aaron Hernandez, you know, what happened with him, but Gronk still all-time tight end, but like best wide receivers, they had Randy Moss, who they rejuvenated his career, and he came back to be, you know, an unsensational player like he had always been. But outside of Randy Moss, you have guys that you fill in with like Wes Welker, Julian Edelman, guys that are not considered all-time greats, but were very, very good for the New England Patriots. So there's been no go-to receiver for the Patriots in a very long time. They don't have, I mean, even their running backs at this point, Ramondre Stevenson showed great promise last year, and now he's been a complete non-factor. Zeke is Zeke. You know, he's slow. He's still kind of just a battering ram back there. And Mac Jones just is not capable of winning you football games. He's not. And it used to be okay because he used to be like, he's not going to win you games, but he's not going to lose you games. And the Patriots were still good enough to win football games like that. But now he's actively making bad mistakes. He's throwing the ball into double coverage. He's throwing the ball across the field late. You can't be doing these things. They're mental mistakes as much as they are physical mistakes. And it's clear that I don't think Bill Belichick really has a grasp on how to fix this offense. So I agree with that assessment from Steve and I, where it's like, you have to kind of release the reins a little bit. And if Bill Belichick doesn't want to do that, then it has to unfortunately be the end for it. And you look at it and the whole thing is like, Brady wants to stay, but he kind of wants more of a say in everything. And Bill Belichick wasn't really ready to relinquish that control. So Brady left and he went to Tampa. And that's kind of why they had that falling out. But all in all, like, it's a tough situation because you can fire Bill Belichick if he's not ready to concede that power, that say that he has. You can fire him. But what happens when you hire a new coach and the Patriots are still bad? You know, people, you know, there's going to be people that turn around and say like, well, why did you fire Bill Belichick? He's one of the best coaches of all time. If you're going to rebuild, at least let him be at the helm of it. But that's the problem is if he doesn't want to relinquish control of personnel, which he has a heavy say in, then you're kind of screwed. You have nowhere else to turn because right now it's not working. It's just flat out not working. Ravens, Steelers, these matchups are always impossible to predict. But honestly, the Steelers winning this game 17-10 off I think it was under 2 minutes left. George Pickens touchdown, Pickett to Pickens for a touchdown to take the lead. With a minute 17 left, 14-10, they get a turnover. They get a turnover on downs for the Ravens. And then end up kicking a field goal to win this game 17-10. A very impressive win from the Steelers defense. But at the same time, it is almost, it's laughable, really, just how many drops there were from these Ravens receivers. Mark Andrews, Zay Flowers, Aguilar had maybe one of the worst drops you'll ever see, where Lamar throws on a dime in stride. He has like 3 yards of separation and it goes right through his hands. Like, you can't make it up. Odell Beckham, I love Odell. He has my heart for, you know, how he played in a New York Giants uniform. But holy shit, he robbed the Ravens. I mean, this dude just continuously gets injured, cannot stay on the field. And even when he has been on the field, he's basically been a non-factor. I think at this point, it's like, You made a concerted effort to go out and surround your quarterback, Lamar, with receivers, and all of them let him down this game. Every single one of them. Again, Mark Andrews, Zay Flowers, Aguilar, Odell, they all underperformed. Multiple drops in the end zone, drops that would have been walk-in touchdowns. And it's like, at that point, what can you do if you're Lamar other than just kind of like throw your hands up and say, you know, what the hell? Like, what am I supposed to do? You know, it's brutal. It is brutal what they are doing to him, man. And it's tough to watch. And then you add on top of all of that, all the injuries already that have happened to Baltimore. It's just unlucky. But regardless of all that, these games are impossible to predict with the Ravens and Steelers. It's always just a complete shit show, for lack of a better term. Next game, a trap game. I wanted to bet on this game and I didn't. But Texans going to Atlanta and losing 21-19 is like typical Falcons. CJ Stroud played a great game, still has not thrown an interception. He actually drove the Texans down the field, 11 plays, 75 yards, and he ate up a ton of clock. This drive started with a little less than 7 minutes left and ended with under 2 minutes. A Stroud touchdown to Dalton Schultz with 1:49 left. And then credit to the Falcons and Desmond Ridder. I mean, driving down the field with 1:49, they get down and they end up chewing up the rest of the clock to kick a game expiring 37-yard field goal to win the game 21-19. So an impressive drive from Stroud, a maybe even more impressive drive from Desmond Ridder and the Falcons. They are 3-2. Desmond Ridder still has never lost a home game, which is just like completely insane. But the Texans, I mean, they still looked good. That's a tough loss. That's a disappointing loss, especially because the defense has looked so good over the past couple weeks. And to kind of allow the Falcons to drive down the field, chew up the rest of the clock, and kick a game-winning field goal is definitely a bit demoralizing, but that's football. Panthers, Lions. I asked my friend, how often do you think about Cam Newton? And he says, every single Sunday when I'm watching the Panthers. So just really, really tough. The Lions, without Jahmyr Gibbs, without Amon-Ra St. Brown, Jameson Williams returned for the Lions in this game, did not really have much of an impact, just 2 catches for 2 yards. But Josh Reynolds had a big game. Laporta continues to be a threat at tight end for them. 2 touchdowns for him. And David Montgomery, he's back with Jahmyr Gibbs out. So he gets the full workload, 19 carries, 109 yards, and a touchdown. David Montgomery has been very good for Detroit. Jared Goff, another sensational game for him, 236 yards and 3 touchdowns. And then you look at the Panthers and it's just like a whole lot of upsetting stuff. I mean, they're 0-5. They don't own their first round draft picks. That belongs to the Bears, who are 1-4. So right now, currently as it stands, I think there are a few 1-4 teams. So it kind of needs to see how that shakes up, but they do own the number one overall pick still because the Panthers are 0-5. So it's like, you look at Bryce Young, you got to let him loose a little bit more. I'd like to see him throw it around as much. I mean, he's 25 of 41, so they're really kind of turning him loose a little bit. So I shouldn't say that. But he doesn't look bad. I mean, the rest of this team is not good. Let's get that absolutely 100% clear. This team is not a good team. It's not a well-constructed football team. It is not all on Bryce Young. But you already know that these players are, or these quotes from, you know, Frank Reich had a press conference where he was talking about how some ownership is more involved than others. And in Carolina, you know, David Tepper is a very hands-on owner. Now the reports are coming out that Frank Reich in Carolina wanted CJ Stroud, the coaching staff. They wanted CJ Stroud. It was a done deal that they wanted CJ Stroud until Tepper had a dinner with Bryce Young. And then all of a sudden he wanted Bryce Young and they took Bryce Young. And you kind of see how that's turning out, where CJ Stroud looks great. Bryce Young's really struggling. So I find it upsetting. Like I feel for Bryce Young. You let this ride out, you're stuck with him. You're not getting a quarterback. You're not going to be able to get like a top draft pick this year and get a quarterback. That ship has sailed. It's over. It's not happening. You don't have a first round pick. So just settle in and realize that Bryce Young is your quarterback for the foreseeable future. I think that in general, he needs to put on weight. I think that's probably the thing that's concerning me the most. I don't care about the height. It's the fact that he weighs like 160 pounds. Like, he is not a big dude at all. I don't care what the combine weight said he was. That's not his playing weight. And I think I said that during, I think I said that on this podcast when the combines came out, and they came out with like the height and weight of every player and the quarterbacks and stuff. And they listed Bryce Young at like 200 pounds. I'm like, he is not 200 pounds. He probably stuffed his face. That's all water weight. His playing weight is not 200 pounds. It's just simply not, or whatever they decided to list it as. It's not that. You know, he's lucky if he weighs 170 pounds. Lucky. I don't really think it's that either. So he's a skinny guy. Like, he's not a very big dude. And it's scary. It looks scary out there for him. Like, when he gets tackled by a full-grown defensive lineman, like a full-grown man, 6'2", 6'3", 6'4", DN, D lineman, whatever it is, it's scary. Like, I think he's going to break. You know, you want him to put on weight. You want him to look like he's able to take hits. You know, because there are other guys that are small in the league. Like, even Kyler Murray. Kyler Murray is small. He's short. He is. But he's got some meat to him. He's got, like, some bigger legs. He's got, like, a thicker upper body. Like, he is built. He's a not stocky, because that implies maybe he might not be in shape. But he's a bigger dude, you know? So he looks like he takes hits. He can't. Like, when he runs around, I'm not worried about when Kyler gets hit. That, and he's smart about how he runs around. So it's like, that's different. And I'd rather Bryce Young look like that, because right now he is short and he is skinny. So it's frightening. But right now you just kind of got to buckle up if you're a Panthers fan and get ready for the bumpy ride, because this is your team. The Bengals at Cardinals. Joe Burrow said this was a must win for the Bengals, and he played like it. A week after Ja'Marr Chase said, quote, "I'm always fucking open," he puts up a franchise record, actually, in receptions, 15 catches, 192 yards, and 3 touchdowns for Ja'Marr Chase against the Arizona Cardinals. He's a stud. He is a stud, and that is quite the impressive performance to have after you say, you know, "I'm always fucking open." 15 catches for 192 yards and 3 touchdowns. Yeah, you are always open. And this all happening with T. Higgins out. T. Higgins did not play in this game because he has a fractured rib. So to really be like the center of attention in this game and still just having 15 catches, like, this is the guy going to this game for Arizona. You're like, they don't have T. Higgins. Yeah, sure, Tyler Boyd's there. But, like, Ja'Marr Chase is the guy we have to focus on. 15 catches, damn near 200 yards and 3 touchdowns. You couldn't stop him. You're trying to, you can't. So, very impressive performance. Joe Burrow finally looked like himself. 36 of 46, 317 yards, 3 touchdowns, all to Ja'Marr Chase, and 1 interception. But he looked, the Bengals offense in general looked, finally, they looked capable out there, because Joe Mixon had 25 carries for 81 yards as well. So they had everything working for them. Eagles, Rams, the Eagles win 23-14. It was a tale of two halves. 31 points scored between these two teams in the first half. 6 scored in the second half. I'm sure if you bet the over in that game, you were tearing your hair out, because you're like, wow, 30-some points already in the first half. We're going to cruise to this over, which was, let's check. It was probably like 44 and a half. Oh, it was high. 50 and a half. But even still, you know, 31 points in the first half, you feel good with a 50 and a half over under. 6 points in the second half. 6. So definitely a tale of two halves. Cooper Kupp, back like nothing ever happened. I mean, 8 catches, 118 yards for Cooper. For Cooper Kupp. A.J. Brown had another huge game. 6 catches, 127 yards. Dallas Goedert finally showed up to a big game. 6 catches, 117 yards and a touchdown for him. He had a huge first drive. I think he had like 4 catches for like 50 yards and a touchdown in the first drive for the Eagles. Puka Nacua, though, don't sleep on him. There was still plenty of action for him. 7 catches for 71 yards and a touchdown for Puka Nacua. So he is definitely the wide receiver two on that team. There's going to be plenty of passes for him to catch continuing moving forward. I would still be a little worried about the Eagles defense. Their secondary has not been particularly good. So we'll see how that is moving forward. But all in all, still a win. Hey, a win's a win. A win's a win. And the Eagles are 5-0. The Rams are 2-3, which not horrible, honestly. The Jets and Broncos, this game was gross. The Jets win 31-21 with a game ceiling strip sack. I think it was Quincy Williams strip sack Russell Wilson when the Broncos were trying to drive down the field to tie the game. It was picked up by Bryce Hall, who walks it in for a touchdown, and the Jets end up winning 31-21. The Jets dominated this game. They were definitely dominating this game from the get-go. It's just that every time they got into the red zone, they could not get into the end zone, and they had to keep settling for field goals, field goal after field goal after field goal. I mean, look at this. Four possessions here. Greg Zuerlein to open the game, 30-yard field goal. They get a safety. Greg Zuerlein, 26-yard field goal. Greg Zuerlein, 27-yard field goal, 22-yard field goal. So that's 4 field goals inside the inside 30-yard attempted field goals, which is like you're there. You're in the red zone. You're smelling a touchdown and you just can't punch it in. So you have to settle for these chip shot field goals, which is just demoralizing. They had one big play, Breece Hall, full workload, and of course he shines because he is a sensational football player. 22 carries, 177 yards, and a touchdown for Breece Hall. A 72-yard touchdown for him. But other than that, it's like you're settling for these chip shot field goals, which is just a demoralizing thing. You get the big Breece Hall run for a touchdown. And then at the end of the game with 30 seconds left, the strip sack from Quincy Williams and the Breece Hall return, a 39-yard fumble return for a touchdown to seal it 31-21. But like, you got it. Your red zone offense has to be better if you're the Jets, because you let the Broncos hang around in this game for entirely too long. And now if you're the Broncos, by the way, you're staring 1-9, 1-8 in the face, because here you just lost to the Jets. You have the Chiefs on a short week, Thursday night. You're playing the Chiefs. Then you have the Packers, where the Packers kind of iffy. You can possibly win that game, but who knows? Then you have the Chiefs again. And then the Bills, and then the Vikings. So those are your next 5 games. 2 of them, the Chiefs, you're losing. 3, you're losing because of the Bills. You could possibly beat the Packers and the Vikings. I doubt it, though. So you're not in a great position here. Maybe you're vying for that top 2 pick to get Caleb Williams, to get Drake May. I personally think that the Broncos might end up with the 2nd overall pick, in which case they would get Drake May. Or Marvin Harrison Jr. You know, I don't know what the synopsis is there, who Broncos fans would rather have, but yeah, you're looking at top 5, top 4, top 3 pick if you're the Broncos right now, staring down a horrible start to the season. Chiefs, Vikings, a near catastrophic injury for Travis Kelce, who went down with a non-contact injury. He got up and limped off the field. I thought it was an Achilles. It looked really, really, really dangerous. But they shot him up with God knows what at halftime, diagnosed it as a high ankle sprain, which it was, and he came out and scored a touchdown in the 2nd half. He ended the game with 10 catches for 67 yards and a touchdown. The bigger news here, obviously you had the near catastrophic injury to Travis Kelce. He seems to be fine, high ankle sprain. I would say he's probably not going to play on Thursday night against the Broncos, just because I feel like the Chiefs probably have a sense that they're going to have a good shot to beat the Broncos even without Travis. So I would expect him to take the short week off, come back next, you know, get the whole 10 days, whatever it is, to rest for football and be ready to go for week seven, that would be. The bigger news here, Justin Jefferson, I'm getting choked up talking about it because he's on my fantasy team. I had the number one overall pick, and I already lost Mike Williams. My team is just in shambles, like really, really bad. The whole while, I was just like, at least I have Justin Jefferson. See you later. He pulls a hammy, non-contact. He is on the IR. He will miss the next four games for minimum for the Minnesota Vikings, who are already 1-4. Their season is shot. And that's all I have to say about it. Their season's shot. It's over for the Vikings. Get ready for next year. Jefferson's out. The Sunday night game, which I was really looking forward to, I thought, hey, this is going to be a really good game. It's going to see like where exactly we stack up in the NFC in terms of like who's at the top. San Francisco's in a different class. Flat out. I think the Dallas Cowboys up until this point actually really thought they might have been Super Bowl favorites. But now I think it should be pretty clear. You don't have a prayer. You are not getting through the San Francisco 49ers. 42-10. 42-10. The Niners beat up on the Dallas Cowboys. Christian McCaffrey, 14 straight games with a touchdown. The Niners are 5-0. I think what's their regular season win streak now? 15, 16 games. They are a freight train. George Kittle, 3 touchdowns. McCaffrey had a touchdown. Juszczyk had a touchdown. They were just pouring it on. Dak Prescott, 3 interceptions for the Cowboys. And Dak Prescott said he won't throw 10 interceptions this year. He already has 4. 3 of them came in this game. So just an absolute shit show for the Dallas Cowboys. They got slaughtered, steamrolled, embarrassed, whatever you want to call it. Do not put anyone... I honestly, at this point, like, yeah, the Eagles are 5-0 too, but I don't know, man. I think this Niners defense is better than the Eagles this year by a pretty significant margin, and I just don't think that the Eagles defense is good enough to stop the Niners, but I think the Niners defense is good enough to stop the Eagles. So it is, I think the Niners and then everyone else, I think the Niners are easily a top 3 team, top 2 team in the entire NFL. They are an unstoppable force. Brock Purdy throws for 4 touchdowns. McCaffrey might be in the MVP conversation, which I know it's a quarterback award, but like what player is playing better than Christian McCaffrey right now? He might break the touchdown record again. I'm saying it for the second straight week. He could do it. And you know, the Niners are thinking like, let's see how long we can keep Christian's touchdown streak going. Like anything inside the 5, inside the 10, they're giving him the ball, whether it's a pass or a run. Like he's getting the ball and he's going to score because you can't stop him. He himself is a freak. That offensive line is great. The receivers, Debo, Ayuk, are insane blockers. So you get them on the edge there. They're going to lay out good blocks for him. They are just a well-oiled machine. And the Cowboys, bye. Your Super Bowl aspirations are shot because you cannot make it out of the NFC. I don't think you're better than the Eagles. And you're very clearly not better than the 49ers. Is what it is. The Monday night game was a stinker. Raiders win 17-13. I was kind of zoning in and out of this game because I was watching baseball instead, just because I thought this game was just gross to watch. I don't know why AJ Dillon had 20 carries, but Jordan Love looked horrible. This was like his first really, really bad game of the season. 16 of 30, 182 yards, and 3 interceptions for Jordan Love. They were bad interceptions. I mean, 2 of them, I think, were tipped up in the air, but one of them was like literally directly to Robert Spillane. Like he was just like sitting in a zone waiting for this slant, and like Love is staring right at him and throws it directly into his chest. Like you won't find an easier interception in the NFL than what Robert Spillane had there. He actually had 2 interceptions. I think one came off to deflection, and then Amik Robertson also had a deflection INT. So Davante Adams in his revenge game didn't actually really do much. 4 catches for 45 yards. Jacoby Myers was the guy that had a good game here. 7 catches, 75 yards, and a touchdown for him. Jacobs also had a rushing touchdown, 20 carries, 69 yards, and a TD for him. Garoppolo looked all right, but overall, I mean, this was a really sloppy game, pretty gross. A game the Packers probably should have won, but Jordan Love had his first real, like, meltdown game of his professional career. So that's that. That is the week five wrap-up in the NFL. Thursday night football is Chiefs and Broncos, and the Chiefs are 10.5-point favorites over Denver. And honestly, I might take that just because why not? I just don't see how the Chiefs lose this game. I don't know. Maybe I'll just put like $100 on Chiefs money line. Who knows? They got to be like minus 400 favorites, though. It's going to be heavy stuff on the Chiefs. So that will do it for this episode of From My Point of View. Thank you all very much for listening. I appreciate you as always. I didn't mention Jonathan Taylor's extension, but it was a 4-year extension. There you go. Thank you all for listening as always. And I will talk to you next week.